Hello, I'm Alan Parsons, and welcome to Time Passages, the story of singer-songwriter Al Stewart. In tonight's programme, we'll hear from some of the many musicians and friends who've worked with Al during his long musical career, as well as rediscovering some of the great tracks which he's best known for, including Year of the Cat, On the Border, Roads to Moscow, and of course, Time Passages.
It was late in December, the sky turned to snow. All around the day was going down slow. Night like a river beginning to flow. I felt the beat of my mind go drifting into time passages. Yes, go falling in the fading light. Time passages. Buy me a ticket on the last train home tonight.
Al now lives and works in California, but he was born in the town of Greenock near Glasgow, grew up in Bournemouth, and after an early career playing electric guitar with various dancehall bands, occasionally sharing the stage with Tony Blackburn, no doubt, he moved to London in the mid-1960s.
Well, I came to London in 1965 in February and started going to folk clubs and trying to get up on stage and play. I, at that time, had not really written any songs. I owned two Bob Dylan albums, and I'd learnt both of them more or less in the order that they appeared on the records. So one of the first gigs I was ever given at Bunge's Coffee Bar, I think I got up and played the whole of the Times They're Changing kind of song by song as they appeared on the record. Well, I went to Bunge's Coffee Bar first because someone had told me that there was an opening spot for a folk singer. It should be mentioned that, of course, I wasn't a folk singer at the time. I just happened to own a couple of Bob Dylan records. I was in Bournemouth. I'd been playing in, I guess you would call them beat groups, at least we did at the time. But I was interested in Bob Dylan, obviously, and all these other singer-songwriters that I met in London seemed to be doing something very fresh, very exciting. And the folk scene seemed a little bit more intellectual than the rock and roll scene, and that was appealing. And wearing a corduroy jacket and living in a coffee bar when you're 19 and discussing Sartre with like-minded people was a long way from, you know, being in Bournemouth and talking about, you know, how do the Safaris get that great guitar sound, which is what I'd been doing hitherto.
The friends I've left back home all right, with laughing words that warm my sight, saying, tell us, how's the city life? I reply, and say just fine. So, you see, I can't go back till I either win or crack. I'm standing in a one-way street. The stage is set, the story incomplete. But it's all right while the lights of the city shine so bright. It's all right till the last winding train fades from sight. That alone in my room, I must stay to lose or win. For these wild bedsitter images come back to hem me in.
Well, Lonnie Donegan was the guy who was probably my first hero. What he'd done is he'd basically taken American traditional folk songs and revved them up to about 500 miles an hour and invented something called skiffle. And he'd basically played these things. They were totally amazing, actually. I've re-listened to some of Lonnie Donegan's records recently, and they're absolutely great. They're still great. On the other hand, my influences in the guitar were really Duane Eddy and Hank B. Marvin. Duane Eddy just sounded like God. I mean, just incredibly wonderful sound. It was all on the bass strings of the guitar, and I saw him once, and the building shook. I mean, this is in a period where amplifiers were very small things, and you had to be quite close to the stage to even hear. And Duane Eddy came on with what looked like industrial cabinets and made this noise that basically squished me back into my seat when I was 14. And I thought, I don't know what this is, but I want a piece of this. This is great. And then shortly after that, I saw the Shadows, and they were wonderful too. So it's an interesting combination. I mean, one part of me was totally into Guitar Heroes, and I wanted to make a lot of noise on an electric guitar. And the other part of me was beginning to get into lyrics and into French literature and things like that. Then I ran into Paul Simon, who was living with a social worker called Judith Pieppi in the East End of London. And I moved in there for really want of having a better place to live. And, of course, it was a wonderful place to live because I was next door, literally, to Paul, and I could hear him composing songs through the wall. I had 3 hours of Homeward Bound one day, and then eventually he emerged and said, "What do you think of this?" and played it. And I thought it was pretty good. And then the next day he wrote a song called Richard Cory, which I thought was much better. So I said, "Well, you know, the Richard Cory is a really good song, and this Homeward Bound thing that you wrote, I'm not really sure about that. Probably throw that one away and keep Richard Cory." Thus began a totally hopeless career at picking commercial music.
The sun goes down on a neon, but half a job is standing at your rich cotillion. Animation by conversation, anticipation, disinformation. Old wine it turns with dust in his eyes. Begs for the tracks from the bottom of the case, man. You never seen a lady lay down, spread a leg like Soho, needless to say. I'm alone on your sheets on a Friday evening, and I've been here all of the day. With nowhere to go. Soho, needless to say, I'm alone on your streets. All of my dreams, and I've been here all of the day. Going nowhere with nowhere to go.
Well, I was living at the time right in the middle of Soho in the West End of London, in a really ramshackle kind of apartment that I loved dearly. I mean, I think there was about an inch of dust on the floor. I don't think it had been cleaned in 100 years. And because I was working at Les Cousins, but we all called it Les Cousins, a folk club that ran all night on Fridays and Saturdays in the winter. Basically, I was getting up about 4 or 5 in the afternoon and working all night and going to bed about, 8 o'clock the next morning. And so consequently, I very rarely saw daylight, which was fine by me. I mean, I liked staying up all night. However, if you're staying up all night, there's not a lot that you can do in the middle of London at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I took to reading The Lord of the Rings. And I think that while I was staying in that particular apartment, I read it through 3 times. A big book at the time, wonderful book. I mean, I dearly love Tolkien. And at some point, I must have decided that a song about an elf would have been a good idea. And so I recorded this basically fairly poppy, folky thing called The Elf that I think sold 496 copies, all of which are very valuable now.
I sat upon the evening hill, the shadows set the night crystal. And as I sat guitar on knee, a voice of flowers called to me. Sing, sing to me your song. For I belong to the night. In the grey morning light I'll be gone. I turned with eyes that strained for sight, and there amid the failing light dimly saw a figure small, heard a voice of magic call. Sing, sing to me your song. Sing for I belong to the night. In the grey morning light I'll be gone. Fumbling fingers found the chords, my trembling lips fought for the words. I stopped to ask the stranger how, he softly said, "No questions now." But sing, sing to me your song. Sing for I belong to the night. In the grey morning light I'll be gone. Then with the magic of the elves, my fingers danced among themselves. A heart with lightness thus endowed formed melodies I know not how. And song played the whole night long. Thus he danced and laughed through the night. And with grey morning light he was gone. The whispering wind plays o'er the hill, and the evening sounds again grow still. A year or more has passed since then. Oh, he will not pass my way again. So I sing, sing to you my song. Sing for I belong.
Among the many budding singer-songwriters Al came into contact with during that period was another emerging star, Ralph McTell.
From the age of about 16, when I first arrived in the West End, I used to come up from Croydon on the train to Victoria and find my way into Soho and Fitzrovia, because there was the beginnings of what became, I guess, the acoustic music scene. And it wasn't so much related to folk music, it was related to beatniks and poems and jazz and some blues guitar players and people like Buck Polly and Pete Brown and Wiz Jones. And I used to just come and almost gawping at these exotic and strange and wonderful people. And there was these, you know, it was a fantastic period of thinking, goodness me, I'm not the only one who's interested in this sort of music. And of course it was a tradition, or if that's the right word, that goes way back into the 30s and 40s, because that part of London has always had a kind of bohemian sort of feel to it. And Brendan Behan used to be there in the 50s, and before that Dylan Thomas and all that arty crowd. So I was already familiar with the West End when suddenly this acoustic music scene started throwing up folk clubs, and I suppose principally the club Les Cousins became an absolute centre in Greek Street. In fact, the Les Cousins had the only microphone that I'm aware of in a folk club anywhere, and we all love to use the microphone. So acoustic music didn't stand much of a chance unless you were going to be in a place where they would sit and listen quietly, and that meant playing it in folk clubs. Al wrote a song called Almost Lucy about the folk music circuit in the 60s, and it's a very good track. Actually, sounds very fresh even today. There's a touch of the old Paul Simons there as well, that rhythm feel that I know Paul used to use it a lot. And of course he was knocking about the scene at that time as well, nicking riffs off of people and tunes and all sorts, and skulking around Soho. There were a lot of people around at that time. There seemed to be everybody that could play three chords on the guitar decided they were songwriters. And I have to say that the Lucy character in that song, I don't know who she was, but she might have fitted into that category, because this is the generation that were putting the world to rights through music, and it was a music of great integrity at the time, I have to say. The idea of exploitation and all that didn't come into it. It was the music of integrity, and we were helping and being part of changing things.
Lucy worked a different club every day, and though she put her mind to it, her heart was never in it. She stayed around just long enough to get paid. She won't pass the time with you, she can't stay a minute. And all these changing faces never bothered her at all. They just existed like a backdrop or a pattern on the wall. Lucy looks like someone who is waiting for a call. She knows they'll come, but no one else can hear at all. Lucy finds the dressing room and the bar, hangs her clothes up, hopes tonight the contract won't be broken. Well, they kick you round so much when you're not a star, make you play all night just for a pittance or a token. But all these imperfections never bother her at all. She says it sharpens your perception when your back's against the wall. Something that enables her to rise above it all, to shrug it off just when it seems to go too far. Hey, 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 I think you almost feel the pain coming on inside. Hey, 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 I think you almost feel it now, and you don't know why. You don't know why.
I met Ian Anderson and Maggie Holland they had a place in Bristol, and I used to play at the Bristol Troubadour so often, in fact, that I was taken off the guest list and put on the residence list. I seemed to be there every week, and Ian was a very good Monopoly player. You know, it seems like a strange thing. But I used to stay at his house when I went to Bristol, so I would play at the Troubadour, which was the local folk club. And then we'd go home, and we'd literally sit around and play Monopoly all night till about 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't think I ever won. I mean, I might have won once, but Ian was a very, very good Monopoly player.
I first came across Al as a performer when I used to hitch up from Bristol to London for weekends to go to the all-nighters at the club called The Cousins in Greek Street, and Al was a regular performer there. And we became good friends, and he was just beginning to go out around the clubs in one of his early sports cars, beginning to get gigs. And he liked company, and he was always a very helpful guy at encouraging other performers, like-minded people and pals. And so fairly early on, he used to say to me, you know, do you want to come to my gigs and you can do a floor spot and you can keep me company on the drive? And I certainly wasn't the only person that he did that to. I know he helped out other performers like John Martin and the Canadian singer Bruce Cockburn when he first came over at the end of the 1960s. I remember Al taking him around. Always incredibly helpful to others. The folk club scene was incredibly active in the mid-1960s, not just in clubs, but also in colleges. It was a major, major part of college entertainment. Al used to come down there a lot to play at Bristol University Folk Club, but also the Troubadour. And the Troubadour was a remarkable establishment. It was named after its London ancestor. And it was a coffee house which actually ran on two floors. And you had you'd do a show on one floor to about 70 or 80 people, and then you'd go downstairs to the basement and do exactly the same show to another 70 or 80 people who were down there, while somebody else took over the hot seat on the stage above. And amazingly, hardly anybody thought this was weird, and most people went along with it. Al used to be one of the most regular and popular performers. There'd always be queues around the block every time he came down, and all the local singers would learn all his songs, and there was even one guy down there who used to dress identically to him as well.
The rain came down like beads, bouncing on the noses of the people from the train. A flock of salty ears sparkled in the traffic lights. Feet squash soggy leaves across the grain. I took my love to Clifton in the rain. All along the way, wanderers in overcoats with collars on parade. Steaming in the night, listeners in the troubadour, guitar player weaves a willow string. I took my love to Clifton in the rain.
It's somewhat strange to me that although Al is such a good songwriter, not many people have recorded his songs. I don't really know why that is. Of course, Pete Bellamy did a very, very memorable version of Nostradamus. And I have recorded a song of Al's called Accident on Third Street, a little piece of black humour. I think when I first knew Al, I was a bit overawed by him. That was back in the 1970 or so. But I think he was maybe more shy than I realised, a little bit reserved. And I gradually got to know that he is a very, very generous person, very kind. I mean, on a personal level, when my then husband Ian and myself were going through a bad patch in about 1979, and Al happened to get wind of it, he was staying with us, he immediately said to us, "Oh, you're both too tired, you need a holiday." And he invited us to California for 2 weeks and gave us such a wonderful time that it did make us feel a lot better. And although we eventually went our separate ways, I'm sure he helped us to remain good friends. I've never forgotten that. It was a very generous gesture. He couldn't have been kinder.
Accident
said, "Don't you think we're going downhill?" And I would hate it to be run of the mill. Oh, love me or leave me, but please don't deceive me, for if you do, I'll know believe me. I want you to know I don't want you to go anyway. And yes, I was doing all right up until now. I'm beginning to think you should have listened to us. She picked up her things and said, "Let's be friends. For all the good and the bad things have their ends." Then she went lazily, leaving me crazily wandering lost. The night was hazy and everyone else looking sure of themselves, but not me. Yes, I was doing all right up until now. I'm beginning to think you should have listened to us.
By 1970, Al had already recorded three albums: Bedsitter Images, Love Chronicles, and Zero She Flies.
Well, Love Chronicles was... Oh, the central song itself was 18 minutes long. That's not the sort of thing that would have been played on the radio. I had actually slipped what many people consider a rude word into the end of the song, so that sealed its fate in England. It was never going to get played. I was going through actually a period of thinking that there was a certain amount of fascism involved in the decision by the BBC to play songs that lasted for 3 minutes and no more and no less. So I wrote... one song that lasted 18 minutes and one song that lasted 15 seconds called A Small Fruit Song, and basically dared them to play them, and of course they didn't play either of them. Love Chronicles, I guess, is confessional in the sense that it was basically about my love life up until that point, and about falling in love for the first time, and about all the stages that you go through before you get to that point. The album featured Fairport Convention fairly heavily. They're actually on every track apart from the title track. And the title track had Jimmy Page, who is to go on to greater things with Led Zeppelin shortly afterwards.
I can remember the first girl that I did love. It was Stephanie. In kindergarten arithmetic classes, she used to sit next to me. I'd pass the sticky sweets under the table where the teacher couldn't see. Although she wouldn't remember me now, sometimes I wonder where she can be. I can remember the first girl I kissed. It was Christine when I was 10. I'd been told we were moving away. I thought I'd never see her again. Oh, don't forget me. I'll be back when they let me. Before you learn how to lie when you're leaving, love is so much easier then. School, oh, would you believe 300 boys and no girls at all? But you're a fool if you should leave. Just think of the joys of rugby, football, and prep in the morning, and brow cream and acne, and cross country running, and to kill evil thoughts. I'm surprised that I survived. I ran 10,000 miles with my back to the wall.
The last of his so-called confessional albums, Orange, was to follow. On this, he was joined by virtuoso guitarist Tim Renick, who apart from Al has worked with a vast number of artists, including David Bowie, Pink Floyd, Elton John, Eric Clapton and the Sutherland Brothers.
My first meeting with Al was at Trident Recording Studios in 1972 or thereabouts, when we were, myself and the band Quiver that I was currently with, were booked to do some recordings with Al. Al had expressed a wish to, rather than work with a bunch of session guys that possibly hadn't worked much together before or whatever, he quite liked the idea of using a band, so, you know, rhythm section. Working with Al was quite different to working with a lot of other artists. I mean, one thing that particularly interested me was the fact that the amount of research that Al put into his songwriting. I mean, I've never really, I think in that respect, it's very hard to find anybody else to compare him with, really. So he struck me as being quite original and unusual. And I know he was striving in a way to broaden what he was doing to. I mean, he was a very established folk artist at the time, and I think he felt he wanted to reach a bigger audience. Working as a folk singer, as it were, in those days, you can make a very, very good living. So it was quite a bold move, I think, for Al to want to get into sort of more of a rock situation with his music. Al's work particularly with the Past, Present and Future album was really a prime example of this sort of depth of research. I think it was very successful. It was a very interesting piece of work. I mean, this was also the day of the concept album, which was people were more likely to listen to a whole album as a piece of work in those days. And I think even some record radio stations in America would play whole sides or whole albums. So it actually sort of fitted in the context of the times very well. I think it worked very well.
All summer they drove us back through the Ukraine. Smolensk and Vyazma soon fell. By autumn we stood with our backs to the town of Orel. Closer and closer to Moscow they come, riding the wind like a bell. General Guderian stands at the crest of the hill. Winter bought weather the rains, oceans of mud above the roads, blowing the tracks of their tanks to the ground while the sky turned to snow. All that I ever was able to see, the fire in the air glowing red, silhouetting the snow on the breeze.
Well, Roads to Moscow and Nostradamus are the two that people tend to remember from Past, Present and Future, if they remember any of it. Roads to Moscow, what had happened is that by 1972 I'd discovered Solzhenitsyn, and I was ploughing through all the Solzhenitsyn books that I could get hold of. I'd also become fairly obsessive about the Second World War on the Russian front, so I was reading things like Alexander Worth's History of Russia at War, of course Shira, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which everyone reads, and a lot of novelists, Arthur Koestler I was reading at the time, I think, and Ilya Chukovskaya, who wrote The Deserted House. And somehow or other, all of these books got themselves into this song called Roads to Moscow. If there's any one book that it was based around in particular, it would be One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Nostradamus, on the other hand, was I'd run into Erica Cheatham, who was writing a book about Nostradamus, and I think she eventually wrote three. And she was in the throes of doing it, and I went round to her apartment, and there were these galleys all over the house, and pages hanging up everywhere. And she was fairly convinced that the Nostradamus prophecies were had come true, and I was much more skeptical, but it looked like very good material for a song. So basically, I asked Erica, what do you think the most significant prophecies of Nostradamus were? And she told me them. And so I wrote them all down and took them home and turned them into a song called Nostradamus. I still, have grave doubts about whether or not Nostradamus foresaw anything at all, let alone all the things that he's credited with, but it's a source of endless fascination to talk about. A lot of people are very much into Nostradamus, and when I did the song, they seemed fairly thrilled that I'd written a song about him.
A king shall fall and put to death by the English Parliament shall be. Fire and quake to London come in the year of 623. An emperor of France shall rise who will be born near Italy. His rule cost his empire dear. Napoleon his name shall be. Franca come and the government driven out shall be. An English king seeks divorce and from his throne cast down as he. One named Hister shall become captain of Greater Germany. No longer does this man observe and bloody his rise and fall shall be. Your ways are leaves upon the sea. I am the eyes of Nostradamus. All your ways are known to me. Man, your time is sand. Your ways are leaves upon the sea. I am the eyes of Nostradamus. All your ways are known to me.
The idea behind Modern Times, if it had one salient idea, was to feature lots of lead guitar, lots of Tim Rennick. I had a new manager at the time, and he was telling me it's all very well to do all these records, but they won't get played in America unless you have lots of guitar solos. And after Past, Present and Future, which had been very lyrical, not many guitar solos, it had been just this dense lyric record, I was in the mood for doing something much more rocky and something much more upbeat. It's a very peculiar thing, the way that we made Modern Times and Year of the Cat, and indeed all the records of this period. I would go into the studio. I really never had any lyrics for anything. I might have had one catchphrase like Year of the Cat or On the Border or something, but nothing else. So we would go in and we would make all the backing tracks because I had, you know, an idea for the tune. And when I had about 40 or 50 minutes of music, I would take all these bits of tape back and listen to them and see what they suggested to me. And for the most part, I could do it fairly quickly. I would listen to something like Flying Sorcery and think, okay, well, I see airplanes, so I would write airplanes into the song. But Year of the Cat was an absolute nightmare because after a year and after several rewrites where it had been called different things and had totally different sets of lyrics, I just really had not hit it. I mean, I couldn't come up with anything. Year of the Cat suggested absolutely nothing to me at all. And eventually I discovered that it was a Vietnamese astrological symbol, and I had a girlfriend at the time who had a book on Vietnamese astrology. So I began looking at that, and that was a nightmare because it didn't work out at all. And then I don't know what. I mean, eventually it turned into a Humphrey Bogart movie and a holiday in North Africa. But I think by that time I was wringing my hands in despair. At one point, the Year of the Cat was called Foot of the Stage, and it was all about Tony Hancock, the British comedian. I think the chorus of it at the time was, your tears fell down like rain at the foot of the stage, bum, 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 bum. And I thought this one was pretty good. And I think the English people that I played it to liked it, and the American record company listened and said, well, you know, no one in America knows Tony Hancock, and so they said, well, go and rewrite it. So by now I'd written about, I don't know, two or three different sets of lyrics for this thing, and it was driving me crazy.
She doesn't give you time for questions as she locks up your arm in hers, and you follow till your sense of which direction completely disappears. By the blue tiled walls near the market stalls, there's a hidden door she leads you to. These days, she says, I feel my life just like a river running through the Year of the Cat. Mm-hmm.
she comes in incense and patchouli. So you take her to find what's waiting inside the ear of the cat.
Alan Parsons had suggested that we use the saxophone on Year of the Cat, and I was pretty horrified because saxophones were not something that I really liked a lot, and I was hoping that we'd get another great Tim Rennick guitar solo, which in the fullness of time we did, but we also got a saxophone. And Alan said, well, I really can hear a saxophone on this, and I know the number of a saxophone player. Can I call him up? And I said, oh, fine, okay. And so he calls up Phil Kenzie, who lived just around the corner from the studio. And Phil was actually watching a movie at the time and really didn't want to come out. And Alan said, well, it'll only take about 10 minutes. So Phil Kenzie very reluctantly came round, listened to it once, played the solo, and then rushed back in time to catch the end of the movie, and that was that. And I didn't really like it at all. And I said, I don't understand this at all. And Alan said, okay, go home and sleep on it, which I did, and I came back the next day, and it sounded sort of okay. So I didn't really push the issue, I just kind of left it there. Then, at that point, we had a whole backing track with a saxophone solo on it, and we decided what it really needed was an orchestra. And I'd worked with Andrew Powell before on Modern Times, because he'd arranged the orchestra on the title track of Modern Times. So he went off with the backing track, and he thought up this arrangement for an orchestra, and we overdubbed the orchestra on top of what we already had. So now we had this monstrosity. We had a rhythm track, we had a sax and guitar solo, and we had an orchestra. It had no vocal and no lyrics at this point, but we'd spent a lot of money on it.
Well, Year of the Cat was obviously a big landmark in not only Al's career but mine as well. Tim Rennick was somebody I hadn't worked with until I worked with Al, and immediately I knew that, you know, here was a great guitar-playing talent. Andrew Powell, I think I'm right in saying that I actually introduced him to Al, because I'd worked with Andrew as an orchestral arranger, not only on the Pilot and Cockney Rebel records, but also on my own stuff, which we'd already made a start on by that time. Peter White, again, another very talented guy, great guitar player and a great keyboard player, great sort of all-rounder. And he obviously was instrumental in coming up with the piano riff that you hear on Year of the Cat.
I remember in 1975, in the summer, after all the touring was over, we went into the studio and started recording what became the Year of the Cat record. It was an amazing experience for me. Alan Parsons was the producer, and you know, he was very famous for having worked with Pink Floyd, and you know, he'd been at EMI for many years. So you know, there we were recording this album, and it finally came out in 1976. And the song Year of the Cat, which actually is the last song on the album, became the big hit. And all of a sudden, instead of opening up for, you know, bands like Queen and Linda Ronstadt and Billy Joel, all of a sudden we were headlining 3,000 seaters every night. My favorite track from the Year of the Cat album is actually On the Border, which is the second track, because this is the first guitar solo that I ever recorded, you know, that was ever released on a record. And because of that song, where I play the Spanish guitar, in Al's live show, every time after that, I would come out from behind the keyboards every time we played that song, and I'd sit down on my stool with my Spanish guitar, and I'd play the song, and I'd go back behind the keyboards. And that's what people would remember from me. And eventually, later on, when I started making my own albums, I used this as the basis for my sound, you know, the Spanish guitar with a little bit of saxophone and you know, some orchestral strings in the background. And I would say that's absolutely my favorite song.
Smuggling guns and arms across the Spanish border. The wind whips up the waves aloud. The ghostman sails among the clouds, turns the rifles into silver on the border. On my wall, the colors of the maps are running. From Africa, the winds, they talk of changes coming. The torches flare up in the night. The hand that sets the farms alight to spread the word to those who are waiting on the border. In the village where I grew up, nothing seems the same. Still, you never see the change from day to day. No one notices the customs slip away.
After Year of the Cat was released, I was on tour with Al, and I was starting to write little snippets of music of my own, and Al caught me one day on the keyboard playing this little keyboard riff, which later became the intro to Time Passages, and he says, "Wow, that sounds great. We'll have to write a song one day and, you know, use that as a starting point." And so after the tour was over, we got together, and I had my little keyboard riff, and by that time I'd compiled a lot of other little bits and pieces musically that I thought would fit, and which is why the song actually has so many different parts to it, is because I'd come up with all these different parts and I couldn't bear to leave any of them out. So you know, it's like a musical landscape. It just kind of goes on. And Al wrote the words in a few minutes, as he usually does, and you know, that was the first song that Al and I wrote together, and it became in the USA, at least, a top 10 hit. And you know, I remember the first time I heard it on the radio, I thought, this is great. This is a song that I've written, and it's on the radio, and it was a totally new experience for me. I was very thrilled.
Well, the picture is changing now. You're part of a crowd. They're laughing at something. The music's loud. A girl comes towards you. Once used to know, you reach out your hand, but you're all alone. And those time passages, I know you're in there, you're just out of sight. Oh, time passages, buy me a ticket on the last train home tonight.
Well, Lawrence Juba can play almost anything that you care to think of on a guitar. He was introduced to me as an acoustic guitar player, and he, like myself, he'd been a big fan of John Renbourn and Burt Jantz. And unlike myself, I mean, I can play a little bit of either Burt Jantz or John Renbourn. He can play both of them simultaneously, which is a remarkable achievement. And he can play electric guitar and bass and almost anything else, and he has his own studio. He's a multi-talented person. And as a producer, he was actually the easiest person in a way to work with, simply because the budget was so small that we didn't really have time to sit there and scratch our heads and say, you know, shall we bring over, oh, I don't know, the Red Army Choir or something to sing on to sing on this next song. We just basically played it and that was it and moved on. And it was very refreshing to do it that way.
I think Between the Wars is quite different from the previous albums. The previous batch, kind of the 80s era stuff and the early 90s, tended to be more kind of pop-oriented. And what I wanted to do was get back to the Al Stewart that I had been exposed to as a teenager, and that was really that was the approach, was to not try and make a kind of a radio pop record, but just to write some interesting songs. He came up with the idea of doing it the period between the wars pretty early on in the game, and so that gave us a very clear direction. Working compositionally with Al was kind of interesting because there were a couple of tunes. Betty Boop's Birthday basically was just something we composed spontaneously when Al was delivered a new Taylor guitar and was enjoying playing it and was just kind of leaping around the studio, tossing off little chord sequences, and we, within the space of about 10 minutes, came up with this little instrumental. The other tune that we wrote together for Between the Wars, The Age of Rhythm, was a little more complicated because Al had fallen in love with a kind of a jazzy tune of instrumental tune of mine called Rules of the Road. Essentially add a lyric to it and do that tune for the album, and I pointed out to him that guitaristically it was just never going to work to have him sing it. It was in an altered tuning, it was in the wrong key, it was all too complicated. So we took the basic idea of the piece, and I found a way of kind of converting it into something that was a little more Al compatible. What was more interesting, even than the compositional process for Between the Wars, was the arranging, because it was really my responsibility to arrange this record so that it was built around the core of two acoustic guitars and could be reproduced by two acoustic guitars on stage, but still had enough character and flavor to make it an interesting listening experience. And by adding a little bit of violin and clarinet and just very light percussion and drums, it gave it some drive and some color that was really quite satisfying. That was probably the most satisfying part of the process for me, was actually taking these songs and fleshing them out into something that would work as an interesting listening experience.
The reason that Al made it particularly of all those singer-songwriter guitarists who were hanging around in Soho in the 1960s, was that he really... I don't mean this badly at all, but he really did want to be famous, and he set out, you know, to be a very professional artist, to do all the things that was necessary to have a career. He would always know on a week-to-week basis exactly the sales figures on his albums and things like that. Took really, really strong interest in the business side of his career. But on top of that, he did also have the songwriting talent and the drive and the stage personality to back it up. And it's a very rare combination that performers have those two things, and Al definitely had it.
I think although Al has achieved an enormous amount of success, particularly in the United States, he has a great sort of cult following in the UK. But I still, despite the success he's had, I still feel that he is underrated. I honestly believe he is in the top five of the great British songwriters. His lyrics are just completely unparalleled, as far as I'm concerned. I compare him with right up there with Bob Dylan and the likes of people like that. He is an amazing songwriter.
I would say that Al Stewart has really made a mark for himself as being an artist of some uniqueness, where he has taken the sum of his influences, as far as his historical and literary influences, as well as his enduring love for English pop music, and synthesized those into a very very immediate and very digestible artistic statement. I think a very palatable, but at the same time thought-provoking artist. And I think that, you know, maybe that's it, palatable and thought-provoking, with a nice side of Cabernet.
Al's a great wine buff, and he loves to share good wine, and he loves it if you can learn even a little bit to appreciate some of the subtle variations. Although he's, you know, not above, you know, having a pint of Guinness if he doesn't fancy the wine that's on offer.
Well, I've been collecting wine for about 30 years, as all the world seems to know. I'm actually, in the last 5 years, I think I've probably been featured in more wine magazines than I have in music magazines, which is rather odd. I mean, you know, when you start getting full pages in the Wine Spectator and you know, you're not in the music mags anymore, it's kind of strange. But Andy Warhol says anyway that you get your 15 minutes of fame, and I think, in retrospect, Year of the Cat was that. After the record came out, I remember driving down Sunset Boulevard in a convertible, flipping, just pushing the buttons on the radio, because there are so many, I think there are 87 different radio stations in LA, or there were at the time. And it seemed as though every button I pushed was playing my song. Now, I can't even begin to explain how wonderful that is after, say, spending 10 years listening to the BBC and never hearing yourself. It was night and day. I saw no reason ever to go back to England, really.
Oh, I have no need of a chant or creed. You told your waiting crew for the winds of chance, they'll bear us straight. And you spoke as though you knew, so you paid no mind to the warning signs as you gave your words so free. Don't change your tack when the timbers crack on the dark and the rolling sea.
Time Passages, the Al Stewart story, was produced by Anita Farrell and John Morrison and was a Jam Communications production for Radio 2. Thanks to everyone who took part, Al himself, Ralph McTell, Ian Anderson, Maggie Holland, Tim Rennick, Lawrence Juba and Peter White. I'm Alan Parsons, and I hope you've enjoyed this insight into the musical career of Al Stewart. I'll leave you tonight with one of my favourite tracks from the Modern Times album, The Dark and the Rolling Sea. Bye for now.
Desert the skies, and the rigging strains as the hands of rain reach down to wash your eyes. And your Osmond stands with his knife in hand, and his eyes spell mutiny. Don't call my name when your ship goes down. The dark and the rolling sea.
88 to 91 FM. This is Radio 2 from the BBC.